A podcast of the cinema.
Starring me.
Sure.
I'm
Dave White.
Yeah, I'm Dave White. I'm a film critic for The Wrap.
Yes.
I'm a, what else am I?
A pepper.
That's basically it. I am. I had a Dr. Pepper today at the movies.
Yeah.
It tastes so good. It's the best soda. I know that I say grape is the best, but grape is kind of a sometime thing. I mean, it's my very favorite, but it's also less able to be found. Mm. But what you can find easily is a good old Dr. Pepper.
Not a fan.
Ugh.
Never been a fan. Mm.
So nice.
I had a brief Mr. Pibb period as a child, but never Dr. Pepper.
Who are you anyway?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. Thank you for asking.
Tell me.
I'm film reviews editor of The Wrap, co-host of the Who Shot You podcast on Maximum Fun, and co-host of Breakfast All Day.
Oh, speaking of that.
Oh?
I want to talk to your so-called fans, if they're listening. I'm about out to here with your Breakfast All Day people.
Look, they're going to wrap their heads around.
No. I'm gonna tell them some things.
All right,
right now.
This is coming from Dave, not me.
If you are one of the people that are out there harassing my husband and Christy Lemire and Matt Atchity and by extension Ben Mankiewicz, who doesn't pay attention to anything you say, I've now heard two people say, how come you're not Breakfast All Day anymore? How come you're not What the Flick anymore? Bring back What the Flick. And here's my answer to you. Matt and Ben, Christy and Alonzo didn't take What the Flick away from you. The Young Turks Network took What the Flick away from them. And the Young Turks Network owns the name and the YouTube channel and everything else, and they're not giving it away. So, those four people, heroically,
thank you,
started over, came up with a new name. No, the video doesn't have the same production quality, because they're shooting it at Christie's dining room, that's why.
Yes.
They don't have a studio anymore. They got fired! This is not difficult to understand. So, here's what I want you to do. Shut up. Shut up. Enjoy the fact that these people cared enough about you and your complaining ass to do a new show.
We're trying to keep the dream alive.
Yeah, yeah. Dreams. There. I've spoken.
Fine.
Don't thank at you. Me about
thank,
this.
Thank you.
Either.
No, we are... We were very happy doing What the Flick, and then What the Flick stopped being a thing, and so we are carrying on with a new name.
Yes.
Get behind it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Get into it.
It is the end of the first quarter.
Of what?
2019.
Oh, yeah.
It's March 31st.
You're right.
The year is a fourth done.
25% of the year is over.
Have you started buying my Christmas presents yet?
What if I have?
Because usually the answer for you is yes.
Unlike you, I don't talk about Christmas every day.
I know, and I like that about
y'all,
you.
Y'all, there's a reason he wrote a book about Christmas movies. You should try living with it, because it can wear you down.
You have often taken it as a point of pride.
Oh yeah,
that,
I do. I do.
That early in the year,
I do. I've already
begun the process.
Oh, I'm filling that stocking.
Okay.
Oh yeah,
that's what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah,
that's
yes, all yes, I yes, yes. Here and there, bit by bit.
Okay.
Deal by deal, you know how to. You know what a cheapskate I am.
Oh, I know. But, you love a bargain.
But December 25th rolls around. That stocking is a cornucopia of beauty.
It's true.
Yeah. But yeah, I just don't like need to see Christmas things in front of my eyes every day.
Okay.
For the other 364 days a year. In fact, I don't want to see Christmas things in front of my eyes every day for 364 days out of the year. I don't.
And that is why I respect your space.
Yes, I thank you very much for respecting my space. I don't want to complain about Christmas in the way that the old What the Flick fans complain about What the Flick. I want to complain about you and the toaster.
Oh, this is going to be rich.
I spent 5 entire minutes yesterday Windexing the toaster.
Uh-huh.
It gleamed.
Yes.
It gleamed like the top of the Chrysler building. It gleamed. It was a gorgeous vintage toaster from the 1970s or 60s. Who knows?
I think 60s probably.
Anyway, I got right in there.
Are you mad that I sullied it or that I didn't praise you for doing the wiping?
I didn't get any praise. That was number one. Secondly, it didn't. You immediately made toast, like, not 10 minutes after I was finished. And you crumbed it up. And you got your smudgy fingerprints on it. So this morning, I Windexed it again. And reader, he did it again.
Okay, but here's the thing.
He toasted, he crumbed, he smudged.
Whenever we have owned,
who can tolerate such behavior?
Whenever we have owned a vintage board game or magazine,
yep,
you are the first person to be all like,
open it up, use it, enjoy it.
Exactly.
Yep.
So why am I being excoriated for making toast in the toaster?
You're not. What I'm saying is, clean up after yourself.
What, so every time I make toast, I got to turn it upside down to get the crumbs out now?
That'd help. No, don't, because you'll dislodge
something. I'll do it wrong.
You'll dislodge something.
I'll break everything.
You might. You never know what you're going to do.
Exactly. Just
gently brush the crumbs away, perhaps into the sink. It's nearby.
Oh, and then you'll get mad because you just cleaned that sink.
No. I never do that.
Okay, fine.
I never do that.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'll try and toast better
respect
for you. Am I buttering too loud for you?
I'll let you know if you are.
God. Sad news this week.
Yes.
We lost Agnes Varda. At the age of 90, she and Jean-Luc Godard are arguably the last of the major French New Wave figures who were still alive.
The last of the household names, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, of the biggies. And she was, of course, the most prominent woman in that bunch.
Yeah.
And had an extraordinary career because, you know, she began as a photographer. She emerged as a filmmaker in the French New Wave. Married fellow Nouvelle Vague filmmaker Jacques Demy. They came to America and made films here for a while. She was frequently going back and forth between France and Los Angeles. In her, you know, 80s was, or 70s and 80s was still making amazing documentaries like The Gleaners
and a bit of a career resurgence, yeah, in her 70s,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and 80s.
Like kind
fact.
Of like suddenly was, you know, reemerged as this woman making very kind of personal.
She became popular again.
Yeah, yeah, like she, yeah. She was making these very personal films that were sort of about her making movies, you know?
Right.
And also before that had spent a lot of time and effort making sure that Demy's films and her own were being restored, remastered, yeah, reissued. So, you know, if you enjoyed seeing, you know, Umbrellas of Cherbourg or Young Girls of Rochefort when they were theatrically reissued in the 1990s, you have Agnès Varda to thank. If you picked up a Blu-ray of, you know, Jane B. par Agnès V,
yep,
on Blu-ray in the last couple of years, again, that's Cine Tamaris, that's Varda's company,
yep,
making sure that stuff was happening. Just a giant and somebody who...
The tiniest.
The tiniest giant. Yes, she was a wee thing. But I found her very inspirational. I remember seeing her autobiographical documentary, The Beaches of Agnes, which she made sort of to celebrate turning 80, that was kind of about her own life. And I just thought, I hope that when I'm 80, I'm still that interested in the world and open to new ideas and eager to embrace new technologies and all the things that she
loves. Then you better change your ways.
I know. I'm not doing that at 51, but maybe at 81, it'll be a whole other story. I don't know.
I loved her. I cannot recommend enough for this last stage of her career. The Gleaners and I.
Yes.
Which came out in 2000, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of my very favorite documentary
films. Absolutely. And Faces Places was my favorite film of 2017.
Of last year. 2017, yeah. I would really love it.
And it's streaming on Netflix.
I would really love it if when we have our friend who is negotiating day and time with us right now, who wants to come on and talk about Jonas Mekas. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if we could just make the whole episode about him,
cool dead
about
people.
Varda, about Barbara Hammer, about Larry Cohen.
Yeah.
Because, like, all four of them in the past several months have died. And all four of them, in one way or another, made really amazing films.
And very influential ones.
Yeah. And so I know we're talking about, you know, academic art film, and we're talking about experimental avant-garde stuff, and we're talking about, you know, genre horror and genre filmmaking. Yeah, so that would be a nice extra episode, I think.
I like it. We're gonna make that happen.
This past week, you hosted a Q&A for a screening of a repertory screening of Daisy von Schillermayr's Party Girl.
Yes.
Came out in 1995, stars Parker Posey as a club kid who becomes a librarian.
Arguably the definitive Parker Posey role.
It's the one that everybody I know can quote backwards and forwards.
Sure.
And I realized that watching it again this...
Natasha!
Watching it again this week.
How many of those phrases you've incorporated into your daily life?
Yeah, like an hour ago, you said something to me, and I went, uh-huh. 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 Uh-huh.
That's Guillermo Diaz's line.
Moving my...
Doing your scratching.
Scratching, well, my imaginary turntable. Everything from her saying, I don't know, to...
I say that to you all the time. Yes. I don't know.
The whole putting books back on the shelves wrong sequence...
What's up, Buttercup? The rent, and I ain't paying.
At the end, when she's like, I'm really serious about graduate school. Like,
while a male stripper is grinding on her at a birthday party.
I love it so much. Mm. And I remember thinking in 1995 that it was a little dorky. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt a little dorky for its moment.
Uh-huh.
And also it felt very much like it knew exactly what it was supposed to be.
Oh, yeah. Because here's the thing.
It had New York club kid life down pretty well, musically at least.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, never. I wasn't there in the 90s.
Well, there were a lot of club kid figures in the movie, like Lady Bunny and Heclina.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's funny because I know so many people in my life who had a moment of sort of fabulousness. Men and women who like were very much like scenesters
on the scene,
nightlife people, and you know, dressed crazily, and then eventually they become academics.
Yeah,
you know, they become anthropologists or like, you know, experts in medieval literature or whatever. You know, so like I think that's very much a trajectory where you scratch that person and deep down is somebody who's serious about graduate school.
I filed Sylvester's You Make Me Feel Mighty Real under Diva's Mail. So here's the craziest part about this situation, this screening. Mm-hmm. The New Beverly, the Quentin Tarantino-owned repertory cinema here in Los Angeles.
Yes.
Has begun doing Monday and Wednesday afternoon matinees.
Yeah.
Why? Who knows why? But the only time you'll get to see the films they're showing on Monday and Wednesday are on Monday and Wednesday. It's not like they're also showing it at night.
Yeah.
This is, do you want to see this film? Well, it's on Monday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Take it or leave it.
And it was packed.
It was.
It was nearly sold out.
People love that movie.
And so...
And it has been hard to see for a while. Like, it kind of went out of print for a moment, and now it's streaming on Amazon.
Yeah.
But it's streaming in what looks like a DVD that was shot off of the VHS tape. Like, it does not look great on Amazon. So the chance to see it in 35 was exciting.
Just lovely.
Yeah.
Then you got to do the Q&A with Daisy Von Schiller-Mayer.
Yeah. And she was terrific.
She was really cool.
She was very funny. And she has directed a ton of television.
I lost you in the theater because it was pitch black when I walked in. And because you were like, oh, I have a seat for you.
Yeah, I
did. And then you just wandered in the theater and I was like, I need a soda. And so when I got my soda... I couldn't find you anymore. And I walked in, and God bless Frank. Our friend Frank, who I think is probably listening, in the pitch blackness, was sitting on the very last row of the theater, which is always my favorite place to sit.
Sure.
And I'm looking for you. But in the darkness, I see a hand waving at me. And I'm thinking... I don't know who that is waving at me, and I don't think they know who I am. I think they think I'm someone else. So I just ignored it. I kept looking and looking, looking. And then he did it again. And he's like, Dave! And there he was. I need a seat. I sat with him the whole movie. And then I had to jump up at the very end and skip a chunkier Q&A.
Yes.
Because, y'all...
Monday is not a good parking day.
If you live in Los Angeles, you ought to know something about going to a Monday afternoon matinee at the New Beverly. Take a lift.
Yes.
Because...
there's street cleaning from noon to three.
Street cleaning is happening and you can't get a space. I had to go all the way down. Either I'd go three blocks down La Brea to find a meter.
Lordy.
And that was a two-hour meter.
Right.
So at 2 o'clock, I had a two-hour meter. And at 3:55, when you were doing the Q&A, I thought, I got to get back to that meter.
Indeed.
And that was my day.
Well, Phil Blankenship programmed the matinees and did a bang-up job. And did you, I don't know if you were getting your soda, did you see the trailers?
No.
They had all these trailers of other Parker Posey movies.
That are going to be shown?
No, just to see them. I see. There was like a House of Yes trailer.
It would be fun to watch the House of Yes at the New Beverly.
Mm.
There was any of those other movies.
House of Yes, Kicking and Screaming, Best in Show, and Josie and the Pussycats.
Right. They should show Josie
and the Pussycats. They should show Josie and the Pussycats. That would also sell out, I think. And I would also happily do that Q&A.
It would be to be like April doing that Q&A.
April wanted to do this one, but I asked first.
Yeah. Yeah, so let her do the next one.
No. April gets so much. When's it going to be my turn?
Yeah, when is a man going to get his opportunity?
April's just getting things handed to her left and right. No, actually, to be honest, I listened to her interview with Daisy Von Schiller-Mayer on Switchblade Sisters, which it was very helpful in prepping for the Q&A.
So you stole everything that she knew to do your Q&A.
Yes, that's what I did. I usurped her. Exploited her.
Eventually, we're going to talk about the movies, but I have I have one more thing to talk about.
Oh,
I've been talking about this for a while, but I have finally my guest episode on the Good Christian Fun podcast.
Yes,
finally dropped this past Wednesday,
and it's a hoot.
It is. It's fine. It's they're great. I'm fine. I love that show. I love those two people. They don't know me at all, but they're my friends in my head. And so it was finally, it was wonderful to meet them and do a podcast with them. They gave me candy. They gave me pizza.
Well,
so,
all right.
So they are really my friends.
What's
now.
Not to like?
We talked about the 80s musical output of one Leslie Phillips.
You may know her.
Not the actor Leslie Phillips from England of olden times, no. But the lady named Leslie Phillips who sings Christian music of the 1980s, who eventually quit Christian music, changed her name to Sam, and kept on recording albums for a 30-year career.
And scoring Gilmore Girls and Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes. You should listen to this because I was so excited to be there. That I karaoke'd Amy Grant's Sing Your Praise to the
you
Lord
did indeed.
Well beyond the point of necessity.
Yeah, you knew more lyrics than one of the hosts did. I was impressed.
Well, you know, 1982 was my year of being 18 years old. I'm very, very old. The only person who's been older as a guest on that show was Caroline's mother, who is probably my age.
Well, if we're going to mention other podcasts, I got to host Pop Rocket this week.
Oh, yeah, you did.
I had never hosted before.
I thought you had.
I've been on it a bunch, but I've never, like, hosted, like, steered the ship, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you did when Guy was gone
no,
for a while.
No, Lewis was hosting, and I was paneling for Margaret.
Oh, all right. So you hosted.
Yeah, and it was, and I think it was also my first time doing the show with all three of the women of the show. Mm-hmm. So it was Margaret, it was Winter, and it was Karen. And we
so you were a less good guy.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Believe me.
Guy Branum, the host.
Yes. There were moments where I was like, oh, God. Guy would have something really, like, super on it to say here. And I'm just like,
Well, you know, when you're hosting and you think that you are not cutting it like Guy would, ask one of the ladies to say something smart, and they will.
Believe me, I receded a lot on this episode, and especially because
Karen will lay it down.
Exactly.
Whatever you need to have opinionated about, she's got something.
Oh, well, literally none of them are lacking for opinions. But it was about Us, the Jordan Peele movie, and you and I had already talked about it, and I had already done an episode of Who Shot You about it. So I was like,
right.
If people really want to know what I think about Us, they'll know. Yeah. So I'll let these folks do their talking. Anyway, it came out well. You should check it out.
Maybe I will.
Oh, I don't mean you.
Well, I haven't listened to it yet, but I will.
I did plug your Good Christian Fun appearance.
Oh, did you?
Yes.
Well, then, if you mentioned my name on the show,
then
I'm really going to listen.
Catnip. Hearing your name is better than seeing your face.
It really is. I mean, really. It really is. Dumbo.
Yes.
Yeah, we got to talk about these new movies, y'all.
Yes.
Dumbo.
Dumbo.
Or as I've been calling it, Dumbo.
That could also be the alternate title for The Beach Bum, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah. Why don't you explain Dumbo to the people?
All right. Well, Disney, perhaps you've heard, they've decided that it would be a great idea to take all of their animated classics and remake them as live-action movies with cutting-edge computer-generated technology. And that's just been so great so far. I mean, okay, some of them have been okay.
I thought Cinderella was really solid and good.
Didn't love it.
We both liked the stoner Pete's Dragon.
Much, very much, yes. I liked Beauty and the Beast.
Sure.
Again, do I think any of these movies need to exist? I mean, you know, they're all remakes. They're remakes of movies that are great. Like, that's the reason I think Pete's Dragon is my favorite is because the original Pete's Dragon is sort of eh. It doesn't hold up very
well. The original
Pete's
Dragon is not very good.
Yeah.
So,
you know, but like, as much as I admire what Bill Condon did with Beauty and the Beast, like, it's always going to be my second favorite Disney Beauty and the Beast because the animated one is, you know, legendary.
Right, right.
So Tim Burton, 21st century Tim Burton.
Who ruins almost everything he touches these days.
Oy. Does Dumbo. Now, you might think to yourself, well, but, you know, here he's got a character who's, you know, physically unusual, but possesses the soul of a poet, so it's going to be like Edward Scissorhands. Or what? It's set in a 1920s circus? Oh, then surely it will be visually kind of, you know, dark and seductive and strange. It will not. It will not be any of those things. It will be about a circus of human characters who are not very interesting, and an elephant who the world learns can fly at the end of Act One.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, it's just stuff and things, and I'm going to steal your mommy away. And I will give them points for the fact that Michael Keaton's Snidely Whiplash villain is Walt Disney.
I know.
They're not even hiding it.
It's weird. All right, so here's... You've barely sketched over the plot.
There's not much of one.
If you've seen the original Dumbo and sobbed your way through the original Dumbo, you will remember that this it is a very short little animated feature. It's about...
64 minutes.
Yeah, it's about 65 minutes long. And it ends with him showing everybody that he can fly. And he's the hero. The end. Well, you can't, you know, release a 65-minute movie into theaters these days.
Oh, that you could.
In these times.
If only. So many movies would be so much better if they were 65 minutes long.
Yeah. So you are correct that the first 40 minutes of this film is a tightened up version of the animated feature.
But instead of a talking mouse, we have adorable children.
Minus the crows.
The crows, yes, well. Also minus them.
Which, you know, Disney keeps Song of the South in the, you know, the quote-unquote vault.
Yes.
And I'm not going to assume that they're ever going to let anyone see it.
Well, you know, when they announced, you know, Disney Plus, their streaming service.
Yeah.
One of the things they said was, oh, we're going to, you know, we're going to open the vault. And everybody's like, oh, really? Really? The vault?
All of it? Everything?
You're going to show Song of the South. They haven't said. They're not going to.
If you are young, it is unlikely that you have seen Song of the South.
You may have seen the animated sequences.
Maybe.
You know Zippity-Doo-Dah.
Correct. But when Alonzo and I were children...
They still would reissue
it. They still reissued it to theaters. And I remember my mother taking me to see it when I was 5, 6, 7, 8. Who knows how old I was. And at that age, you don't understand really what you're watching. It's like a nice cartoon, you know.
Yeah.
With live-action people. You don't understand how wildly racist it is. And same goes for the crows in Dumbo. You don't understand as a child that these are racist caricatures that you're watching.
Like from the set of Amos and Andy.
Yeah. And so, for some reason, well, I know the reason. Dumbo is so beloved.
Yes.
An animated feature. And the crows occupy about 4 minutes of
Get the best song in the
film
movie.
Film time, they get the second best song in the movie.
Yes.
Baby Mine is the song.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so after all these years, despite, I assume, lots of people's objection to the crows, that they stay. They're in the film. They're not getting cut out.
Oh, yeah. The Dumbo gets reissued on Blu-ray or whatever else, I'm sure. You know.
And I think it's because they're not the main thrust of the film. Like, right. Song of the South is about racism and is racist. And
Song of the South is basically like, it's one of those Gone with the Wind movies of like, those wonderful...
Those old plantation...
Antebellum
those wonderful plantation times. Yeah. So, anyway, the first 40 minutes of this movie is the Dumbo that you know.
Yes.
With a... with a baby mind sequence that lasts what feels like 11 seconds.
Yeah. Remember how in the Jungle Book, you never got almost no full songs. You'd get a verse of Bare Necessities or, you know.
You mean the live action Jungle Book?
Yes. Yeah,
yes.
Or Trust in Me or, yeah. You know, I Want to Be Like You. That, yeah, Baby Mind gets this sort of just a blip of a moment.
Now, in the original film, that's the gut kicker moment.
Oh, yeah.
That's the moment when
out your handkerchiefs.
You are crying. And they just race right through it here. And I was kind of stunned by that.
Yeah.
There are a lot of stupid human tricks going on here as well. Colin Farrell, Eva Green, Michael Keaton, Danny DeVito. All these people are in the film, as you said, not especially interesting.
Yeah.
Their stories are not especially interesting. Colin Farrell's weird Southern accent is bouncing off the walls. And not always where it should be.
True.
Which is strange, because he's a good actor.
Yeah.
I liked Eva Green the best out of everybody, yes. But that's because I always like Eva Green the best out of everybody in a film. The moment when Dumbo flies, the end of Act One, that is the most legitimately, for me, thrilling part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I felt tension and I felt elation watching that happen. And then they, you know, Dumbo was a hero, Dumbo was a star, and the movie still has like an hour and a half to go.
Exactly.
I was like, well, what are they going to do now? Well, I'll tell you what they're going to do now. They're going to bring in Michael Keaton as a Walt Disney-esque person who is building a Walt Disney, a Disneyland-style park.
Called Dreamland. Very Art Deco influenced.
With, you know, merchandising opportunities. Like when they bring Dumbo into Dreamland and make him a part of it, they sell little Dumbo dolls to kids. But he's the villain.
Yeah.
And he's a bad person. And you're like, who said that was okay for Tim Burton to do? Like, Did everyone at Disney just think, oh, tee-hee? Or did they not think it really Disney-ish?
They must have noticed. They can't not have noticed.
What is the creative decision-making behind
that? I think they were sort of tee-hee. They figured that enough time has
passed. What if there was a Walt Disney who was a bad person? Is that what they were thinking? Alternate universe where Walt Disney wasn't everyone's hero grandpa?
As opposed to the saint they give us in Saving Mr. Banks.
Yeah, I know.
Right. Which also starred Colin Farrell.
Exactly.
Maybe they figured that he's so genuinely unimpeachable that they could do this sort of bizarro world Disney and get away with it, you know, even though he's not.
I suppose. It becomes fairly laborious after that. It wants to give you moments of, will something bad happen? Will something bad happen? Will something bad happen? No, nothing bad is going to happen. And then they do it again.
Yeah.
By the end of the film. And
yeah, you get to see Dumbo and his mother separated twice. So
yeah.
Parents, you'll enjoy that. I was in my review of The Wrap. I talked about how it reminded me of those 70s Disney movies where an animal can do an extraordinary thing and someone wants to steal him.
Yeah.
So this is basically Million Dollar Duck or Gus. But instead of laying golden
you're
eggs,
telling me kicking, the donkey can kick a football
or kicking field
let's
goals,
let's steal him.
It's a flying elephant.
I felt like the production design was actually quite beautiful. I liked looking at it.
Colleen Atwood's costumes, of course.
The costumes are really great. Lovely. Yep. The circusy stuff was nice. I liked ultimately the moral of the film.
Which was
wild animals should not be in captivity in circuses.
True, yes.
The original Dumbo takes circuses as a given because in the 1940s in the United States, circuses were a given. They were actually still quite a popular form of entertainment that would come to a town and people cared about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who does care about that kind of thing anymore, but does Ringling Brothers still exist as a traveling entity?
I don't know. I think there's been a lot of dialing back on the circus in years of late. I did like the fact that in this movie, when the train is taking them off to perform, like, they're playing all these really out-of-the-way places.
Yeah.
Usually when the animated map appears on screen, it's like, you know, Chicago, New York City. And here it's like...
Joplin, Missouri.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. So the... that is literally where they stop.
Yes.
They stop in Joplin.
No offense to anyone who lives there. It's lovely, I'm sure. But it's just that it's not a bustling metropolis.
Maybe it's nice. I don't know. The film just feels like a big money-making venture.
Yeah, it didn't... And nobody felt like they were super jazzed something with this material.
Not a sense of joy. The character design of Dumbo, sometimes really cute and adorable. Sometimes he looked sort of glassy eyed and dead in the face. I that was odd, to these little glimpses of, you know, staring off in 1,000 yards away, Dumbo.
I didn't pick up on that, but I'll take your word for it. But no, I mean, you're right. Like, I don't like Cinderella as much as you do, but that movie does feel like let's look into the psyche of the wicked stepmother and see what she's about, you know? And, you know, I think, you know, like Beauty and the Beast, I think the idea of this is a grand old school musical. Let's do that as a grand old school musical, because we've already done it on stage. So we know that we can do this with people, you know, there. I mean, even Maleficent, for its flaws, like, let's explore this like a woman scorned, like avenging angel narrative. You know, this one doesn't.
This gives us nothing.
The idea of the very ending maybe
gives us a full 90 minutes of new material, but still gives us nothing.
You're right. The thing about, like, maybe animals shouldn't be in a circus is sort of tacked on at the end, and it does mean something, but it doesn't feel like that was the driving force behind this version. It just feels like somebody at Disney is going down a list
somehow. Yeah.
Next, Aladdin. You know,
I saw the trailer for Aladdin,
and
I don't care.
Yeah, I'm not.
I really don't care.
I don't.
One more complaint about Dumbo, though.
Oh, do.
Baby Mine.
Yeesh.
Is a beautiful song.
It is.
It's a beautiful, sweet, kind of heartbreaking song.
Kinda.
Why in the world do you give it to the most anemic sounding singers? Arcade Fire does the cover for the film, and it's like me, 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 me. Like, who said that was a good idea?
Go to YouTube, find the Bonnie Raitt version from the Stay Awake album.
It's gorgeous.
And it has more heart and feeling in 4 minutes or whatever than this entire version does. Not just of the song, the whole movie.
This entire film, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about the new movie from Hong Sang-soo.
Okay.
It's called Hotel by the River. I don't know what sort of distribution it's getting around the country. I believe it's from Cinema Guild, I think. And don't quote me on that. I might be wrong. But he is one of South Korea's most prolific filmmakers. And you can always count on his movies opening in the U.S. these days, at least, and getting some traction. Particularly if there's something like Claire's Camera and they start Isabelle Huppert, you have all these baffled people showing up at the Lemley Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and when it's over going, ugh, what was that, you know? This is his latest, and it is about a man who is a poet. He's in his 60s, and he is in a hotel by the river in the winter. He's there at the
hotel. It is Cinema Guild.
He's there to meet his two estranged adult sons. One of them is recently divorced. The other one seems to never be involved with any woman. The one who's never involved with women is also a successful art house filmmaker. And they're meeting him there because the father has called them there to tell them that he has had a vision of himself dying soon. And they're like, yes, so? That doesn't mean it's going to happen. You know, they're sort of annoyed that he's, you know, could we have FaceTimed, you know?
That's it.
Meanwhile, at the hotel, there are two women staying, a woman and her friend. The main woman is Kim Min-hee. Kim Min-hee is in lots of Hong Sang-soo's films. If you've heard us talk about him before, you might remember us talking about how she's the woman that he had an extramarital affair with on the set of one of the first films they did together.
Yes.
And it became a big scandal in South Korea. And he did not get divorced from his wife. And he broke it off with Kim Min-hee. And yet she's still in all of his films. Fascinating, right?
Okay.
Anyway, she plays a woman who has been recently broken up with, and so she's there to take a weekend off to herself with her good female friend. They meet the old man, and the old man thinks of them as not people, but as angels. And he tells them that. He keeps saying, "You're so beautiful. You two women are so beautiful. I think you are angels." And aside from the fact that, you know, they can see, the women can see everyone around them, it's never really clear if anyone but the old man can see them. So it may very well be that they are, but we aren't ever told explicitly if they are or if they aren't.
This sounds very Cemetery of Splendor.
There is a sequence where everyone sort of falls asleep in a nap time situation. And when they wake up, like 2 feet of snow has blanketed the ground all around them. And everyone says, "Well, I was only asleep for like 30 minutes. Where did all this snow come from?" No explanation. The sons and the father do a lot more talking, and you come to realize that the sons resent the father not only for treating their mother so badly, but because they themselves are afraid of becoming like their father. The one who's getting divorced doesn't want to talk about it, pretends that he isn't getting divorced. The women talk about the filmmaker when he's not around, and they talk about him in descriptive, you know, ways that suggest that he is Hong Sang-soo.
Right.
Yeah.
What? A director is making a movie about a filmmaker and it's autobiographical?
Yeah.
Shut up.
So here's what's interesting about his films to me. I love his films. You walk away from them always feeling that you've seen something very slight in terms of action and plotting. But like an old Eric Rohmer film, everyone just keeps talking. They just sit and drink and eat and talk and talk and walk and talk and talk some more. But unlike Eric Rohmer films, they don't talk about the subject at hand. Uh-huh. Like Eric Rohmer is the guy who is a rebuke to all the times you've ever sat in a movie going, if they would just have one conversation about the real topic, this movie would be over. Eric Rohmer characters talk about the topic nonstop, and then they talk about it some more. And then when you think they're all talked out, Eric Rohmer says, you know what, there needs to be one more conversation about the topic. Hong Sang-soo, his people keep talking, and they are never talking about the topic. They're talking about everything else. They're talking about the snow. They're talking about how drunk they are. They're talking about, you know, why did we have to walk all this way in the cold? What were we thinking? Like, but what you're looking at and how he's zooming in and zooming out, he's showing you what he wants you to think about them. So it's very observational in a visual way, not mm-hmm. so much in a dialogue sense.
Right.
His people are confused. They're awkward. They're uncomfortable. Sometimes they don't even see the point of what they're doing themselves. That's up to you to piece it all together. In other words, he kind of makes you work.
And you love that.
Oh, I love that so much. I paid money for a ticket to see this. I paid money for a ticket to see Dumbo. And my ticket to Dumbo felt like I threw my money into the street. Is the equivalent of being fed like sugar cubes. Not only do I not mind a director that makes me work, I'm hungry for it.
You prefer.
So, when you get a chance, it is called Hotel by the River. Write down that title. It's beautiful. It's this gorgeous, like, silvery black and white film. It's in black and white, by the way. And, you know, it's like 80 minutes long. It's real short. So, shorter than Dumbo by a good half hour. But far more appealing.
I got to see Diane this week, which is the first film from Kent Jones, who is he's been a critic. He was a curator of the film program at the Film Society of Lincoln Center for a long time.
Yeah.
He also did the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut.
Uh-huh.
This is his first scripted feature.
Yeah.
And it's quite extraordinary. And yeah. I'm not going to get into the plot as much as you did, just because I think a lot of it is sort of the discovery of it all. But Mary Kay Place, one of our, you know, great character actresses, plays Diane. And Diane is a woman who, as we first see her, seems to take care of other people a lot. She's visiting a cousin in the hospital who has cancer. She's dropping in on older relatives. This is all in around Pittsfield, Massachusetts, like that part of the state. Her son is played by Jake Lacy. He would appear to have some kind of drug problem that he is denying, that she has been down this road with him before, and she's trying to get him to get his act together, and he very much pushes her away. She volunteers at a soup kitchen where she works with Andrea Martin.
Andrea Martin.
Andrea Martin's
and
in this.
Mary Kay Place.
And Mary Kay Place. Well. And Estelle Getty. Not Estelle Getty.
Estelle Getty.
Estelle Parsons.
Estelle
sorry.
Parsons. Like, what?
Estelle How? Getty is no longer with us.
How?
Estelle Parsons.
Yes.
And as you get to know Diane, you come to find out, you know, why she feels compelled to help other people out, what guilt she might be carrying around with her, what her past is with her son and with other members of her family.
Right.
You know, it's a very kind of dreary, wintry movie. You know, it's sort Ooh. Of... Yeah.
Oh! Is this playing in theaters or is it...
It's in theaters, yeah. They sent me a screening. It's in theaters.
Dreary and wintry, you say?
Very dreary and wintry. And it is a movie about working class people that does not... It's not sort of fetishizing poverty in any way.
Right.
It just feels very sort of matter of fact. And it's just this really amazing character study. And Mary Kay Place is phenomenal in it. And I've always been a fan of hers.
I'm excited now.
Yeah.
I got to see this.
You really, I think you would like it a lot. And I heard people on Twitter comparing it to Barbara Loden's film Wanda, which Criterion Collection just put out, which I still need to watch. I still haven't
it's
seen Wanda.
It's sitting waiting in our TiVo.
I know.
TCM
I know.
Showed it and it is sitting and waiting in our TiVo for you.
Yes. I really want to see
it. I will watch it with you. It's great.
You've seen it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, I don't want to give away too much about what happens, but it is, again, it is a movie where it doesn't tell you what it's about all the time, but if you're paying attention and you watch the character dynamic and you listen to the conversations and you see what people are saying to each other and what they aren't saying to each other, a fuller picture emerges of this woman and her life. Mm-hmm. And, oh my God. a great scene where she has to deal with some religious fundamentalists that I think you would really love.
Oh,
I thought was just a great, great scene. A brilliant use of Right Said Fred's "I'm Too Sexy."
Okay. Yeah.
A dynamite movie. Everybody look for this. I think it's probably might just be New York, LA this weekend, but keep an eye out for Diane as it gets to you. It is probably it's among the first movies of 2019 where I'm thinking this is going to be on my top 10 list. Or it's at least going to be up in the running. So yeah, Diane, check it out.
Knife plus heart.
Ah, sounds like it should be one of our extra shows.
That's how it's stylized in the, you know, the title.
In the English title. The French title, I think, is just like a knife in the heart.
A knife in the heart.
Yeah. Oh. Knife plus heart.
Called knife and heart.
Sure.
It is a French film. From Yann Gonzalez.
Yes.
Whose earlier movie I've not seen.
I didn't love it.
You have, but I now
now want, you want to see it.
Now sure, I want to see it.
No, I would too if I had only seen this one.
This is a horror film. About,
yes.
About a series of murders committed by a masked figure,
mm-hmm.
who is clearly deranged. It takes place in Paris in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And the murders are all taking place around the same small porn studio.
Yes, the repertory company, if you will.
Yeah.
Of a porn studio that is run by a woman played by Vanessa Paradis.
Yeah. Vanessa Paradis, if you don't know her, she's the actress who has that very cool gap between her front teeth, and she used to be married to Johnny Depp back in the day.
Is she better known as a singer than as an actress?
She's also a singer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As so many French actresses are. Yeah. And her character is pining for the woman who edits the films. And so she starts making the films in a way that will attract her former lover's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a lesbian trying to court another lesbian by making explicit gay pornography.
Yeah. The deaths in this film, you have to wait a while until you get knife plus heart. Because so often the knife is going into every other part of the male anatomy, including the very first murder in the film. I won't spoil for you, but the minute it happened, I immediately thought of this book of essays by critic Leo Bersani, Queer Theory. A lot of steeped in queer theory, you know, essays called "Is the Rectum a Grave?" It's the name of a real book, not meant to be a joke. That's the name of the essay,
yes.
The primary essay in the book. And this film is bonkers.
Yeah,
it's funny and it's weird and it is so referential of other. Not just horror films, like, honestly, there is some Friday the 13th mythology going on.
Straight up, yeah.
In this movie.
It is formally a slasher movie.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But it has so much that it has taken from films like Cruising.
Oh, yeah.
And The Fan.
Yeah.
There are visual elements in it that recall the Margot Hemingway movie Lipstick.
Oh, yeah.
There are...
You've got to watch Cola de Mono, by the way.
Okay, what's that?
It was my DVD pick a while ago. Uh-huh. It's that Chilean film that I said it's like, it's Stranger Things, but instead of for for Spielberg and Stephen King. It's for gay men whose sexuality was shaped by Cruising and The Fan.
Yeah. How did you see that? Was that a streaming link?
We showed it at Outfest.
You showed it at Outfest.
It's on DVD now.
We can get it on DVD. Yeah. Okay. There are visual non sequiturs that take place in the film that eventually become understandable as the narrative moves forward.
There are moments in the film within the film where we see a scene play out in a straightforward, realistic way, and then we get the porn version of that same scene.
Almost like the porn parody of that scene, but that's how this female filmmaker is telling her own life story.
Is processing what's going on around her.
You might see how it's a film about homophobia turning people into monsters.
Yes.
It touches on gay daddy issues quite a bit.
Yes.
Both in life and in porn, and how often porn resolves those issues sometimes for people. There are elements of the of a fairy tale structure in it as well.
True, yeah.
At
one point I said, oh God, is this another movie about, you know, gay men looking for sex and winding up with murder? And you said, no, it's a movie about movies where gay men set out looking for sex and finding murder.
I believe it is a film about films where gay men have sex and then die. Either from disease or from being murdered.
Yeah, and its placement in 1979 by the end of the film feels very
significant.
Pointed.
Yeah. Mostly because once the end credits start rolling,
do not leave
the theater or stop watching, because there's an entire sequence still coming that is dreamy and beautiful and sad and really moving. I love this movie. It's so weird. So gross. and also really weirdly coy about the gay porn that they're shooting, which in other circumstances I would feel very strongly about in a negative way. But here it feels like they are doing this to keep a romantic element involved in the process. Score by M83, who happens to be the brother of Jan Gonzalez, the filmmaker. Yes. I didn't know that.
A great score. It is both referential to the period, but also its own thing, and I love it.
It is freaky and funny and not like anything you've seen recently.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Knife and Heart. If you can find it.
Yes, Altered Innocence is releasing it.
Altered Innocence is a distribution company?
Mm-hmm.
Because we watched it on a promotional screener from Altered Innocence, their burn mark appears at the top, and I thought somehow that was the name of one of the porns at first. I thought, what's Altered Innocence? And then you told me.
And the Blu-ray is coming out in June.
Is it?
Yes. They're already promoting it.
I don't want to give away any more of the plot. We're just sort of talking around the plot, but the plot is... it's a doozy. So, write that one down, you guys.
Yeah.
Especially you queer people. It's something else. It's not nice.
It's a lot of things.
But it's a lot of things.
You should see.
And finally, The Beach Bum, the new film from Harmony Korine, who made some movies I really love. Gummo, Julian Donkey Boy, Mr. Lonely, Trash Humpers, Spring Breakers. What else? Did I miss anything? Did I say Mr. Lonely?
You did, and Julian Donkey Boy. I liked Spring Breakers.
I think Gummo is one of the masterpieces of the 1990s.
Ugh.
And I really love Trash Humpers. And Mr. Lonely is the most emotionally moving, I think, of his films.
I was thinking today about how Harmony Korine is the filmmaker who I like the least, who I've still nonetheless seen almost every one of his movies.
Why is that?
I spared myself Trash Humpers because I was like, no.
Trash Humpers is the funniest of all of his movies.
I'm sure with
Trash
the
Humpers
riot.
is a stone cold gas.
Hard pass. But I've seen all the other ones and I despise most of them. But I really like Spring Breakers and I quite like The Beach Bum. I was surprised. And I think this is a movie where I think they tried to sell it by what it sounds like on paper. But what it sounds like on paper is very different than what you get. Because on paper, it's like, oh, Matthew McConaughey plays this sort of like charming, lovable wastrel who's drunk all the time. And he's got a super rich wife played by Isla Fisher. And she's carrying on with the also super rich Snoop Dogg. And, you know, it all takes place in the Florida Keys and Miami. And, oh, Jimmy Buffett's in it. And it's this sun-drenched, you know, kooky comedy. But it's not that. It is, if anything, I feel like having Jimmy Buffett in this movie is as almost in a way as subversive as having Michael Keaton play Walt Disney in Dumbo. Because, and I'm not saying that Buffett isn't fully aware of what he's doing here, but basically,
He might not be.
maybe not, but I think he is. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt that he is. This is a movie that it basically is out to condemn people who take Jimmy Buffett songs as a blueprint for
To
living.
the limit.
Yeah. Like it's one thing to vacation in Margaritaville, but when you start living there, you're in trouble. And that's what this movie's about.
The plot is about a man named Moondog, played
Yes.
by McConaughey. He is, by all accounts, a genius poet.
Yes.
And he is also an absolute hedonist.
Yes.
He parties all the time, day in, day out, from sundown to sunup, and through the night. When he sleeps, we do not know. Because he seems to always be awake and always high and having sex with anyone that he can have sex with.
What's the weird McConaughey movie from earlier this year with Anne Hathaway?
Serenity.
Serenity, thank you. I kept thinking about it because this is another movie where he's like on an island.
He's married to Isla Fisher, and that is why also he is extremely rich. She is made of money. And together, like I said in my review for the Wrap, you should go read it because I wrote it. Took me some time to write it. They are like an alcoholic, half-naked Gomez and Morticia Adams. He's doing it with every woman he can meet. She, in turn, is always doing it with their best friend, Snoop Dogg.
Yes.
So it's fine. And they both know about, like, their relationship is sort of like, oh,
Well,
we know this is happening. We don't care.
I don't know. There's a point in the movie at which it seems to be news to him.
It is a little bit of news to him, but not really. And he's fine
I would say it's
when
not a
he's,
deal breaker, but it is news to
like
him.
Snoop Dogg tells him, and he's like, yeah, I figured, you know, like that's.
Well, he sees them during their daughter's wedding.
But here's the thing. It's not just that he likes to party and have sex. He's a horrible person.
Oh, the worst.
He is constantly physically harming people.
Yeah.
And I mean, any chance he gets to push someone off a dock into the ocean,
While they're playing a tuba.
push an old woman in a wheelchair into a wall, smash a bottle over the head of an old person just to take his money.
Oh, actually, I think Zac Efron does that.
They both do it.
Okay.
Yeah. They break out of rehab and they just go robbing people for money.
Yeah.
Violently.
Yes,
they
true.
violently assault people.
And it's weird, like there are like the Zac Efron sequence and the Martin Lawrence sequence are so divorced from the rest of the film that you like it's almost this feeling like, well, if we have to edit this out, we could just lift it from the movie and it wouldn't really affect the plot that much. Less so the Zac Efron part, but the Martin Lawrence part does feel like this sort of little picaresque aside
Yeah,
that
it
like has
is.
a be little mini beginning, middle, and
It
end to
does.
it, you
You're
know.
right about that. So anyway, he is irredeemably horrible.
Yes.
And then tragedy strikes. And this puts Moondog in the position of having to make a choice.
Yeah.
You know, keep on partying and be poor and destitute, or get back to work and make something.
Yeah.
You know, keep doing what you're allegedly a genius at doing.
Create poetry.
Creating poetry. He has, again, he has to go to rehab at one point. He escapes. He runs off with Zac Efron. He gets hooked up with his friend Captain Whack, played by Martin Lawrence, who is the most inept dolphin tour boat captain in the world. He has momentary meetups with his agent, played by Jonah Hill.
Doing this weird, like, Tennessee Williams accent.
Foghorn Leghorn, really. And then there are these inexplicable appearances by Jimmy Buffett for no reason whatsoever.
It's this idea that, like, if you are in the Keys, you will just run into Jimmy Buffett places.
Yeah. This is subject matter that Harmony Korine has always dug deeply into. The scuzzy side of life.
Right. I heard somebody describe this as gummo for rich people.
Yeah. Yes. This is about what a lot of his films are about. People on the margins who don't care about the rules of behavior.
Or long-term consequences.
And this is a man for whom there are no consequences because he's so rich.
Right.
And Harmony Korine has never really passed judgment on his people. And he doesn't even really do that here.
Not really.
Not in a scripted way. There's no one actually saying, except for a judge,
yeah,
you better get your life together. The only other person who's advising him is Jonah Hill saying, I really wish you would write something so we could all make some money.
Yeah.
This movie lives in the fantasy world where poets make a lot of money,
yes,
by the way.
Yes. The movie never sort of goes out of its way to be a cautionary tale overtly. But by the end of the movie, none of the partying looks any fun at all.
Well, this is...
Hedonism becomes this grind of monotony. And so it just, you just think,
yeah.
Again with the PBR, you know.
The formal elements of this movie are Harmony Korine daring to bore you to death with partying.
Yeah.
And I remember walking out of the press screening thinking, I've never been bored in a Harmony Korine movie before, and I was bored in this movie. So I kind of sat with that for a while, and I thought, he's not a bad filmmaker. He's a filmmaker I really like. What is he doing? Why is he boring me here? Why is he relentlessly pushing this tedious, you know, disgusting person doing nothing but getting drunk, falling down in the gutter again and again and again and again and again. And everyone around him saying, but he's so great, when in reality he's doing nothing but terrible things to himself and to other people.
You know what it reminded me of?
Yeah.
The novel American Psycho.
Yes. Yes.
That same sense of repetition and of, yeah, like, you know, what's supposed to be aspirational, but it just ultimately becomes numbing.
Right. And so there is a numbing quality that takes over as the film moves on. And I after I had time to sit and think about it, you know, I had taken notes in the press screening. There's a moment near the end where Snoop describes him as the death of a dream. And that combined with how it is presented, because this isn't partying that looks fun. It's partying that looks woozy and gross,
desperate,
and greasy and desperate. And so,
you know, what happens several times in this movie that I think really kind of captures a thing is that way that people are laughing when they aren't laughing at anything particularly funny.
Right.
And they just go like,
that's him from start to finish.
Yeah. So it's that empty, hollow kind of...
This is a very committed performance for Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
And it's admirable. It's just a person that you cannot stand to be near.
And the cinematography,
if you saw him coming, you would walk away.
Oh God, yes.
You'd cross the street.
And the cinematography leans so heavily into those like Florida sunset postcards.
Yeah.
Like that super orangey sky that they're always selling you.
All kinds of pink neon and terrible Miami Vice kind of furniture.
Yes.
People who have just been frozen themselves into a specific vibe.
Yeah.
And won't leave.
Yeah.
And I honestly believe that what this film is about is a poetic masterpiece worth the cost that you have to pay for it. That you have to pay for it, and that the people around you have to pay for it. Because by the end of the film, when he's sort of doing the thing he's supposed to do again, you're thinking, oh, so you get to just wander off into the sunset. The worst person alive.
Yeah, I don't even. I mean, that's in there. I wasn't even thinking of it so much about the poetry as much as how much it's about the sort of the limits of
the end of fun.
Yeah, definitely the end of fun. But I mean, like, I think like the limits of the sort of not bacchanalia. What's the word I want here? The limits of the Dionysian existence.
Yeah. Yes.
That ultimately it's just like,
that's a word I used in my review.
The hangover, you know, the perpetual hangover of the perpetual.
This is the hangover movies. If the hangover movies were really about how life actually works.
Right. Well, I think the third one wanted to go there and didn't quite pull it off.
Yeah.
This one totally does.
So,
and subsequently no one is seeing it.
What?
The Beach Bum. This movie is tanking.
Oh, is it
really?
It is
Matthew McConaughey's worst opening weekend.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Even like worse than like Mud opened on a third as many screens and did like twice as much.
Oh, all right.
And I saw it in a theater with four people.
Fascinating. It's not fun. And I wrote about here's an interesting thing. The review went up Friday, and all I've had is people talking to me. People commenting to me saying, oh, I wish it were good. And I was like, no, please go back and reread this review, because I'm not saying it's a bad film. I'm saying it's a film about bad times.
Yeah.
And about bad people. And about a filmmaker that dares to push you to the limits of generosity of feeling toward the characters. You know, dares you to dislike them.
It's a movie that makes you feel better about not going out ever.
I am not opposed to hedonism. You want to party and drink and do drugs and do all the sex? Enjoy yourself. But this guy doesn't just do that. He harms people.
Yes.
And that's, you know, don't harm people.
No bueno.
Yeah. So, yeah, I liked it. It's the least fun Harmony Korine movie that I've ever seen. I don't think Julian Donkey Boy is fun because it's sort of a difficult subject matter.
Yeah.
But
I despise Gummo and Mr. Lonely. I admire.
You are
what,
so wrong about
I admire
Mr.
what Julian Donkey Boy is trying to do, but I don't think it particularly works. I think that Spring Breakers is daring and audacious, and I think this movie is audacious in its own way.
Yeah. Today is the International Trans Day of Visibility.
Yes.
Not the Trans Day of Remembrance.
Right. It's like the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day.
Yes, this is the Trans Day of Visibility. Therefore, instead of DVD picks this week, or
as our
DVD picks this week, all our DVD picks, streaming picks, are films that are about trans characters by trans filmmakers or starring trans
performers.
Or they are documentaries.
Or documentaries. About trans people.
Yeah. I think this is a very important day. And the reason I think it's important is because of what I see anytime someone talks about it on the internet. when I hear it talked about, when I hear about the trans day of visibility talked about on the internet, invariably there is some disgusting person going after the person who posted the information.
Right.
You're literally posting information. Today's a trans day of visibility. And someone is in the comments being like, well, that's stupid. And trans people are
bathrooms.
Yeah. The singer, Maria McKee.
Mm-hmm.
She was in the band Lone Justice in the 1980s. She posted on Instagram either today or yesterday that, that her, life partner of right now is a trans woman. Yes. And she started getting these crappy comments on Instagram. But and she's tough because she blocks you like that.
And she really cared about your opinion about her relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And so every time someone comes out and says something about this, there is always someone there.
To be grotesque.
To be gross. Yeah. So, you guys, watch Tangerine. We made the list. I'm just going to read the list.
Okay.
Prodigal Sons. Now, I don't know this one.
Oh, great documentary from Kimberly Reed. She started out making a movie about, you know, being a trans woman going back to her high school reunion, having been like a high school football player.
Yeah.
And then along the way, dovetailed into a whole other family story that was stranger than fiction. But it's a terrific documentary.
Drunk Town's Finest.
Yes. From Sydney Freeland.
Who is a trans filmmaker.
Who's a trans filmmaker. Yeah. She also did a great web series called Her Story, if you want to check that out. But yeah, Drunk Town's Finest tells three stories, one of which centers around a trans character.
I just blipped over Tangerine, but it's from Sean Baker, who made The Florida Project. It's an earlier film from him.
But the leads are trans and contributed a lot to
They collaborated on the story with him as well. Now, I did not see Assassination Nation.
Yes.
And did trans people like Assassination Nation, the ones who saw it? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't think they hated it. I didn't see any protests about it.
Okay.
It does feature a trans actress playing a trans character.
Not that all trans people think the same way about films.
No, certainly.
But I don't know much about this movie because you saw it and I missed
it. There are four principal teenage girl characters. One of them is a trans character played by a trans actress.
Okay.
And the film is inclusive without sort of like skidding to a halt to be like, trans moment. You know, it's woven in as part of the tapestry.
Are they the assassins?
They are defending themselves.
I see. Okay. A Belgian film from the 90s. Called Ma Vie en Rose.
Oh, God, yes. I showed this to my class.
Which is about a little...
A young, like, five-year-old boy?
Transgender girl.
Yes.
Who, played by a little boy.
Yes.
I
learned this term this week. AMAB.
Assigned male at birth.
Assigned male at birth.
But I'm talking about the actor, child actor.
The child actor, the character is a girl... but her family can't look past the externals.
Yeah. It's sweet and dreamy and sort of a nice early, narrative feature that at the time felt very gentle and wise. Now, I haven't seen it since the 90s.
It holds up. I screened it a couple years ago for my queer cinema class at Chapman. And, you know, what I think is interesting is so many people who don't understand these issues mischaracterize how this works. And very often you have people like Jazz on I Am Jazz. As soon as this person can talk.
As soon as she could talk.
Yeah.
Jazz was saying,
they're telling you
I'm a girl.
Who they are.
Yeah. You guys watch I Am Jazz? It's such a good show. Was it on TLC? It's on TLC. Yeah. But you get to see her from the age of like 3, 4 in home movies.
And like, when did she get interviewed by, there's like a news segment where she's
Barbara Walters talked to her when she was 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now she's 18.
Yeah.
Anyway, Gun Hill Road.
Mm-hmm.
which stars Isai Morales, and who is the other actor? Who is the trans actor in the film? What's that person's name?
But yeah, Isai Morales plays a guy coming home from prison, and one of the things that he has to wrap his head around is that he has a daughter, who is played by Harmony Santana.
Okay. Now, is it? This is the one that I think I saw it with you at Outfest, but I don't remember much about it. Whose story is it? Both?
Both of them, okay. Yeah. You know, I mean, the narrative driver is him returning home from prison.
I see.
But it's mainly about her and where she is in her life now and him having to understand that.
Yeah, so that's Gun Hill Road.
Yeah.
And then Paris is Burning. If you still haven't seen Paris is Burning, it is...
streaming on Netflix.
One of the all-time... classic queer documentaries entirely about trans women in the 1980s, in the late 1980s in New York.
And
if you like the show Pose, everything it knows came from Paris is Burning.
Also, check out Kiki, for that matter.
Oh, yes. Speaking of, yeah, Kiki from the next... the next generation of ballroom folks.
And speaking of trans filmmakers, today is also the 20th anniversary of the release of The Matrix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Now, I've been reading lately that there are so many trans themes in The Matrix. But I would have to go back and watch The Matrix to remember what those are or to see them with fresh eyes.
I mean...
because I wasn't looking for that.
Yeah. Thing. I mean, they're certainly right there in Cloud Atlas.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, I guess in The Matrix there is that notion about, you know, the body and versus the mind kind of,
I suppose.
Yeah. I would like to read some of that. I don't really know, but I'm sure they're in there.
And I guess we should rewatch it.
Yeah, it's been a while. I haven't seen it in ages.
That's it. We're done. We're not done. What else?
We have a Patreon.
Oh yeah, that sure. Whatever. Okay.
Patreon.com/ Linoleum Knife. Say you want more like this.
and of course you do.
And how could you not?
Yeah.
We offer three additional programs that are subscriber exclusives.
I will tell you about them. Okay. LKTV, which is about television. Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics. Linoleum Nights, which is a show about whatever we want it to be about.
Pretty much.
And it's live on our own Facebook page, locked down for the people who subscribe at that high. Linoleum Nights is I'd call it a, here's what's going on this week in the world, and we're just going to blabber about it.
Basically.
That's the show.
But we also have merch. We also have Google Hangout opportunities, a monthly viewing party.
Tomorrow
that we
is
have.
April 1st, and we will be talking about what the new...
We got to figure out what our April movie is going to be.
Yep.
You know, we'll a private podcast recorded exclusively for you on a topic of
private
your choosing.
Private Knife is what it's called.
All kinds of cool stuff. So patreon.com/linoleumknife, all starting at $1 a month.
Right.
So go see what we offer and what works for you and become a subscriber. It would be so cool of you.
Yeah.
We're going a little long this week, so we'll skip letters, but we'll have more of those next time. So in the meantime, thank you all for listening. Go check out all of our friends online. You know, my other shows, Who Shot Ya and Breakfast All Day. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out our friends Bibbs and Whitney on their shows, Cancel Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. The latter is on the Schmoes No Network, and check out all the good stuff over there. Listen to Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, All Things Cozy, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us that 5-star review. It does help people find the show. Leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, etc. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next time with more. And until then,
goodbye.